Buddhassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. Tonight I'd like to offer some reflections on a teaching of the Buddha's called Transcendental Dependent Arising. It's a big title, but put simply, it means a teaching on a chain of cause and effect, one thing giving rise to the next, that starts with suffering, dukkha, and goes all the way to the end of suffering, enlightenment, nibbana. It's important for us to remember that the Buddha didn't just teach about suffering. He taught the way out of suffering as well. This teaching is interesting because it starts with dukkha and it looks on dukkha, not quite as a friend, but as a teacher. Suffering is an invitation to wake up in our life, to wake up to the realities of life and to challenge some of our assumptions about life. And when we understand suffering truly, then we are motivated to find a way out of suffering, to put in the effort and energy that's necessary to find peace. And so suffering may not be our friend, but it can be a good teacher. And you can think of it like the alarm clock that wakes us up in the morning. We may not like the alarm clock, but we know that if it wasn't there, that we wouldn't wake up in time to get where we need to be. Of course, we can ignore the alarm clock. We can get angry with it. We can turn it off. We can put on the snooze button and have a bit longer, stretch out the time before we do what we need to do. But we appreciate that we have it, because without it, we wouldn't wake up in time. And so suffering is like this, an invitation to wake up. But as long as possible, most of us try to avoid having to pay attention to it. We want to turn it off or keep the snooze button on for as long as possible in our life. And very often, it's not until suffering comes right up close to us that we're prepared to take a look at it. And this, in fact, mirrors this approach to suffering, and the fact that it can be a teacher mirrors what happened in the Buddha's life. As a prince in the palace, his father, the king, deliberately tried to protect the Buddha from anything that might cause him discomfort and lead to dissatisfaction with life in the palace. Because when the Buddha was born, it had been predicted that if he stayed in the royal household, that he had the potential to become a world-ruling monarch. But if he left home and took up the spiritual life, he had the potential to become a fully enlightened Buddha who could show others the way out of suffering. But his father, the king, preferred to have a world-ruling monarch as a son than a spiritual wanderer. And so he deliberately set up the Buddha's environment in a way that he would never come in contact with the realities of life, particularly that he would always have comfort and luxury, and that any sign of things like sickness or things wearing out or people getting old, that they would always be removed from the Buddha's world, so that he wouldn't know that each person, once they're born, is bound to get old if they don't die before that. And so it wasn't until the Buddha went out from the palace and looked around for himself in the world outside, that he discovered old age, sickness and death by coming in direct contact with it. He saw someone who was aged and bent over with broken teeth and grey hair. And he saw someone who was sick, and not someone lying in a nice clean hospital bed, but someone lying in their own excrement who smelt foully and who had flies all around them. And then he saw someone who was dead. And the sight of those three things really shocked him, because he hadn't been exposed to those realities previously. And we might say to ourselves, well, that's a bit far-fetched. How could the Buddha possibly not have known about old age, sickness and death until he got to be in his 20s? But if we think about our own experience, even though we know that people die every day, they die when they're young, they die when they're just born, they die when they're middle-aged, and they die when they're old. They die when we expect them to, we die when we don't expect them to. Still, we think that we're not going to die. It's always going to be someone else. And even though we know that people get sick, they get so sick that they can't get out of bed, they can't look after themselves, still we like to close our eyes to that and pretend or hope that it's not going to happen to any of us. And although we know that each one of us, if we live long enough, is going to get old and we're going to lose the strength and the vitality that we have if we're young now, if we're old now, we can remember maybe the strength and vitality we used to have, we still like to close our eyes to those facts of life. We cover them up. We colour the hair. We make sure that we wear clothes that don't reveal too many of the things we don't like to notice in our body. And we continually try to close our eyes to the facts of life. And in my own experience, I know that even though I was starting to open my eyes a bit to the facts of life, it took suffering coming right into my own household before I really understood that these facts apply to me and mine. And this is, for most of us, the experience. We have to have suffering come right to our doorstep, or right into our house, or into our own mind and body before we're going to take notice. And in my own experience, in my 20s, when I had still a great hunger to understand life and to know what was the way to find peace in life, I took a trip to India. And I was just overwhelmed by the suffering that I saw there. And how could it be that people should have to live with such hardship? And it quite knocked me over. But while I was there, I got very ill. And I got so ill that I had to come home before I had planned to for medical treatment. And so I discovered that even someone like myself could get sick. But still, when I looked at how I could come to terms with the suffering that I'd seen and the suffering in my own life now with my illness, as I got better, as I recovered, I could see how the tendency of the mind was to try to look for some way of just juggling the pieces in my life so that I could almost forget about the suffering that I'd seen out there. How could I organise my life now so that I could maybe dabble a little bit in trying to understand suffering and do something to ease suffering, but without rocking my own boat too much? When I came back to Australia, I realised it's pretty good here, even if I hadn't realised that before. And so how can I organise these things so that it won't be too disruptive to my own life? And as I went through the struggles of how I was going to do this, my father, who was my very good friend, said to me, "Well, I don't understand really what you're going through, but whatever you decide, I'll support you in any way I can." And we had this conversation, and the next day he dropped dead. He had a sudden, unexpected heart attack. And so when suffering came that close, only when it came that close, only when all the pieces that I thought were mine to rearrange were suddenly scattered over the whole of my life, only then I really understood, suffering means me too. Now, each one of us is going to have a different experience in our life that's going to bring home the fact of suffering, not only to our doorstep, not only into our own household, but into the marrow of our bones. And all of us, I guess, are looking for an easy way out. And sometimes we can avoid looking, but we have to put a lot of effort into it. One of the ways that we avoid looking at suffering out there or inside ourselves is to change conditions so that we temporarily move away from or change the suffering that's arising. And during the meditation, or even while you're sitting here now, you'll be aware of the fact that when pain or discomfort arises in the body, that we try to remove that pain by changing our position. Discomfort arises, and before we've even realised it, we've moved so that temporarily the discomfort has gone. But we can't move always and continually in order to make the discomfort in the body disappear completely. And unless we stop long enough to pay attention to our experience, we'll miss the fact that there is suffering inherent in this physical body. The body is dukkha. We have to constantly look after it and tend it, change it, in order to move away from the suffering that's there. In the meditation, we have the opportunity to stay put long enough to observe the fact that the body is dukkha. And if we have the experience of illness, chronic pain, things that won't go away by changing our position, then we know for a fact that this body is suffering. Apart from moving physically in order to reduce the discomfort in the body, we very often move from one place to another. We change towns, we change states, we go to the other side of the world, hoping that whatever difficulties we've experienced in one place, we'll leave there and that they won't follow us to the next place. We might change jobs, we might change partners, we might do all kinds of changing work in order to move away from the suffering or unsatisfactoriness that we're experiencing in our life. And the Buddha likened this kind of relationship to dukkha like a dog with mange. A dog who has mange doesn't realise that the mange that's causing the discomfort is in the body itself. And so when he's lying in the shade, he thinks, "Oh, lying in the shade, I've got this terrible itch. I'll move into the sun." So he moves into the sun, and for a little while there's a little bit of comfort. But he's taken the mange with him into the sunshine. So after a little while, the mange starts to irritate again, and so he gets up, thinks, "Well, sitting down is the problem. I'll stand up. Standing up's the problem. I'll go and sit down." And all the time, of course, the dog keeps the mange. He just moves from one spot to the other. And this is echoed in the title of a book that I have, which is about mindfulness in daily living. And the title of the book is Wherever You Go, There You Are. Means that wherever you move to, you take yourself with you. You take your suffering with you. Unless you've seen it and you're working to resolve it. So moving, change, is one of the ways that we can mask the arising of suffering or pretend that it's not there. Temporarily reduce it. Another way that we move, if we can't move physically, is we move the mind. And you can notice that in the meditation too. When you feel tired or when you feel bored or when you can't watch the breath, I'll take a trip back home. I'll take a trip to yesterday or to next week or to something more pleasant. And so mentally we do this changing work, this moving work constantly in our life. And we may have to be sitting still and move the mind to another time or space mentally. Or we may actually go and seek distraction, something that's going to take our mind off whatever unsatisfactoriness it is that we're experiencing. And so there are countless distractions in life. In fact, people are making millions of dollars thinking up more and more distractions for those of us who want to get away from the experience of life. And so whatever we find in our experience that helps us to feel a little more comfortable, even if only temporarily, that dulls the edge of the discomfort that we're feeling, then it's likely, it happens very often, that we become addicted. This is where addictions arise. Anything in our experience that helps to dull the edge of that discomfort, that internal discomfort that arises in response to unsatisfactoriness in our life. And we can get addicted to thinking, just like we can get addicted to drugs or alcohol. We can get addicted to food. We can get addicted to, I've got to have something new and stimulating in my life. And it's got to be bigger and better than the last thing I had. These are all the ways that we try to avoid suffering. And we shouldn't think that suffering, this dukkha, just means very big, unpleasant things happening in our life. It certainly does include that, but it starts with the slightest feeling of dis-ease that arises in either our mind or our body at things not going, not being, the way that we would like them to be. It starts there and it moves all the way to the deepest sorrow that we can experience. Very often that deepest sorrow comes through the loss of those who we're closest to. And one of the reasons why it's very important for us to be prepared to take a close look at suffering, at dukkha in our life, is so that we can see what gives rise to the suffering that we experience and why it is so much greater sometimes than others. One of the very common reactions when we encounter severe suffering in our life is shock and horror. How did this happen to me? I don't deserve this. This isn't fair. And we can notice in this kind of situation a number of things. First of all, our shock and horror is likely to be in direct proportion to how attached we are to the person that this thing has happened to, this unwanted thing. When someone who's close to us dies suddenly, there's tremendous pain and this feeling of, this isn't fair, why did this have to happen? If someone who's not close to us, someone who lives down the street or someone we read about in the newspaper, who's died also, maybe died in the same sort of circumstances, we don't get the same rush of shock and indignation. We don't feel the same acute distress. because our attachment to that person is not the same. It's very important for us, if we want to know the way out of suffering, to be willing to take a close enough, long enough look at what gives rise to our suffering, to see how significant our attachment is, the degree of our attachment is in producing the result of suffering in our own life. As long as we distract ourselves, as long as we change, as long as we move away trying to avoid a direct confrontation with suffering, we may be never going to make that connection between the degree of suffering that is present in my heart and the degree of attachment I have to wanting things or people to be and to stay the way I want them to be. And the next thing we can notice when we reflect in this way is that this suffering which comes into our life, it may be in the form of not getting what we want, or in losing what we want to have, or being in contact with things that we don't want to be in contact with. We can notice how these experiences challenge our assumptions about life. It's not fair. We're assuming that life is fair. Maybe we've never even wondered why it is that babies die when they're born, or young children are born with life-threatening illnesses, or are born with physical disabilities that mean life is going to be more than difficult for them, or more difficult for them than it is for us. And maybe we've never wondered, well, is life fair when there are people in this world who don't have enough to eat or enough to drink or a place to live? We never asked ourselves those questions until something that we consider to be unfair touches us personally. So our assumptions about life, whoever said life is fair? This shouldn't happen to me. This shouldn't happen to good people. If I do all the right things, then I should be saved any trouble in life. And yet when we look around, we see, well, that's not how it works. Very often unpleasant things happen to good people. It's not that we want that to be the case, but it is the case. And so we have to open our eyes to see the realities of life, to look life squarely in the face, to see that there are no guarantees, no certainties for us, for those we love, for those we care about, and for people everywhere. And this is what makes it even more important that the way we do things gives us the satisfaction. Rather than thinking, oh, this is definitely going to produce good results for me, we hope that, but there's no guarantee. But we do what is good, what is moral, what is wholesome. We cultivate those good qualities for the sake of cultivating those qualities, because they in themselves, as we're doing it, as we're involved in it, gives us a feeling of satisfaction, whatever the outcome. So we're more involved again in the present moment experience than what we think is going to be the outcome. One of the paradoxes of taking a good look at suffering and seeing it clearly is, first of all, that we have to learn not to take life so personally. Everything that happens to me also happens to lots of other people too. It's not necessarily my personal problem, my personal failure. It happens. And if we have some understanding of cause and effect, and we have some confidence in the law of karma, we know that we can't always know why something is happening in our life right now. But we have the confidence that there's been something in our previous life or in this life that has brought that about, this result about. But even if we don't have that confidence in the law of karma, we can understand that these things aren't my personal exclusive property, not to take life so personally. But the paradox is that we have to understand that suffering and the potential for suffering and the causes of suffering, namely attachment and wrong understanding, apply to everyone. So while we don't take it personally, we also know that it means me. It applies to me. I'm not exempt. And together, these seemingly contradictory attitudes or approaches to dukkha, unsatisfactoriness in life, can help us to really see the universality of suffering. We understand that this is part and parcel of being a human being. This goes with having been born. And while we live with ignorance, not understanding what life is really about, then we are bound to have suffering in our life. This is the universality of suffering. There's pleasant and unpleasant in life. There are good and bad things in life. Certainly it's not all bleak. It's not all dark. There certainly are good times, good relationships. There's love, all of those things. But it doesn't happen according to my wishes. It doesn't happen exclusively according to the way that I want it to be. So this is one of the important truths that we have to understand about suffering. And until we are willing to look directly at dukkha, at the unsatisfactoriness of life, without trying to turn away or avoid it, run away from it, then we'll miss where we need to do our work on attachment particularly, and our wrong view of self, of who's there, who is in this mind and body calling the shots in our life. So when we start exploring dukkha, and of course we can't understand this completely on one look, we have to keep reflecting on it and comparing what we think about life to what actually happens in our life, we have to be willing to keep our eyes open, accept those invitations to look. Then we may come to the conclusion that, well, what I've been hoping would be my refuge in life is not really a safe one. And this is what the Buddha discovered when he discovered old age, sickness and death. At the present time, when he discovered those things, he was still young, he was still healthy, he was still handsome. He still lived in comfort and had good relationships, but he realized that none of those things was going to stay like that. They were all going to change and pass away. And it's said that he describes it that his infatuation with his youth, with his strength, with his vitality, with his wealth, with his power, his infatuation with those things just fell away. And so when our infatuation with these things in our own life starts to fall away, then that's the time we look for a way out, a way of moving towards freedom from suffering, and a way that is going to give us what we want. As we turn away from the world, where do we turn to? And if we have the possibility of coming in contact with the Buddha's teaching and recognizing that this is a path, teaching a path out of suffering to freedom from suffering, then we can have tremendous faith, confidence arising in our mind as we recognize this is what I've been looking for. Not a quick fix solution, not easy, because I have to do the work, but here's the guideline right in front of me. And not only that, here are people who are doing the work right now, who are suffering like I am, and also looking for a way out, and also prepared to do the work. And here's the teachers and the teaching right before me, the opportunity to take this step. And so when we make a connection with the teaching, not only with our head, but also with our heart, recognizing the wonderful thing we found, then tremendous joy can arise in our heart, feeling of relief and gratitude that we've found what we've been looking for. And maybe at first we didn't even realize we were looking for this, but once we come in contact with it, we've understood that where we've been looking for our refuge or our peace hasn't been the right place. But now we've got the opportunity to develop our mind systematically, to become more peaceful and more calm, and also to understand life more fully. So this is the steps on the path from seeing suffering, coming in contact with the teaching, and having the faith, the confidence, the joy, the gratitude, the relief, to actually start to do the work. For many of us, when we do find the teaching, there'll be a niggling doubt. Well, it looks good, but is it possible? I mean, they look happy, but are they really happy? Do they really know what they're talking about? Was the Buddha really enlightened? I mean, does it apply to this day and age? This is called doubt. Skeptical doubt. And it's one of the hindrances, one of the obstacles to practice, but it's also just a natural part of the mind. We all want to know whether we're getting value for our money when we buy something or when we get involved in something. So that's where the doubt comes in. How good is this really? The only way to overcome doubt is to jump in and do it. Because no matter how much other people tell you about how good it is, or that it is actually the path out of suffering, that doesn't help us to be free, doesn't help us to be peaceful. We can come around where people are doing the work, we can listen to the teachings, but still that won't help us. It will just help us superficially. And so the next step on the path, after having confidence and that feeling of joy and the energy that arises when we have that feeling of joy, is to actually jump in and do it. And that, first of all, means restraining our speech and our behaviour through living a moral life, basically keeping the five precepts, the most important one, the first one, to try to live a life of harmlessness. And if we really make the effort to live harmlessly, then the other precepts are all included in that first one. So that's a starting point and an important starting point. But if we really want to taste the fruit of this path, then we have to be prepared to cultivate the mind in meditation. Doesn't matter how much we listen to the teachings and how much we reflect on them, we're still only using one small part of the mind. We need to get access to a much deeper part of the mind, the part of the mind that isn't our ordinary analytical thinking, comparing, contrasting part of the mind, which is the part that's holding up the teaching and saying, oh, I like that part, but I don't like that bit. Oh, that person looks as though they're getting something out of it, but that one, she looks just as miserable as she's always looked. That's the part of the mind which we use in everyday life. And when we don't cultivate it in meditation, that's the way we start to look at the teaching as well. So we need to make the effort, put in the time, do the work, to start to train the mind in meditation. And as we do that, the next steps on the path arise: rapture, tranquility, happiness, and concentration. These are all the result of practicing meditation. The rapture is again this energizing, bright quality which makes the body feel pleasant, and also gives us the interest in the practice. Once this rapture arises, we start to enjoy what we're doing. We enjoy sitting down to meditate. No longer is a chore the thing that we should do. Oh, I haven't done it today. Oh, I suppose I can just squeeze it in before whatever else we have to do today. And a very good sign for our own appreciation of how we're going in our practice is something someone said to me the other day. They said that they're discovering that these days that television is interfering with their meditation. And before it was meditation was interfering with their television, because they couldn't meditate because they had to watch their favourite program. They couldn't meditate because it was time for the news or an interesting program. And so they had to squeeze the meditation in to the non-television, the non-viewing time. But now they're discovering, as they've persisted with their practice, that they'd rather meditate than watch television. And so they switch the television off and enjoy their meditation. And that's a good indication that these qualities of rapture, this quality of rapture is arising, because the meditation becomes the pleasant thing that you would like to do. And you're interested in what you're discovering as you apply your mind in the meditation. The next thing that arises is tranquility, that peaceful state of mind where, this is nice, yes. No longer the exhilaration of the rapture, but the understanding that this is a peaceful state. This is something that's pleasant. This is something to be cultivated. And from that arises happiness. All of these things are essential if we're going to cultivate the path of wisdom, because what we are discovering through our own efforts is that it's possible to find happiness and peace within our own heart. Happiness and peace that's not dependent on the outside world, not dependent on the world or life or people or things being the way that we want them to be. Previously, we've been dependent on those things to give us pleasure, to give us happiness, temporary satisfaction. But now we discover that it's possible to experience happiness, pleasure, peacefulness in our own mind, not depending on those things. And this gives tremendous self-confidence. It's a tremendous impetus to keep on practicing, because we're getting the results ourselves. And this, of course, gives rise to happiness. This happiness which is a more stable mind, a mind that's not so put off balance, knocked off balance by the ups and downs that we experience, that is able to, in the meditation, develop energy, develop clarity in order to look at things more clearly, more honestly, to keep on looking even when it's not what we want to see, rather than having to find some way of easing the inner discomfort that arises when we encounter things in our life, things in ourselves that we don't like. Now we have this inner buoyancy, this inner stability. And so this is the mind that's developed to the point of concentration. But all of these things arise, rapture, tranquility, happiness, on the path to concentration. And because this is a teaching on cause and effect, we have to understand that the happiness is a necessary condition for the mind to be able to enter deep states of concentration. So this path isn't about becoming more and more miserable. It's about becoming more and more happy, but becoming more and more independent of conditions in the outer world, dependent on those to make us happy. We're becoming more independent, and this gives tremendous, as I said, tremendous confidence to continue to do the work. Because the next phase of the path, the outline of the teaching that the Buddha is giving in this teaching, is the path of insight practice. The next step is to be able to see things as they really are. And previously, we've been wanting to look away from, to avoid seeing things as they really are. in the gross sense, avoid seeing old age, sickness and death as the realities of life which apply to me, which apply to the people that I care about. So now we're willing to look at those things. We're willing to keep our attention focused on them, to see them clearly, to understand them. And as we do this practice of seeing things as they really are, we look in our own mind and body. We investigate our mind and body in terms of the three characteristics of existence, that everything in this world is constantly changing, is subject to change. Nothing is static. Nothing is stable. This mind, this body. We see that there's no one in here who's in control, who's making it happen the way that they want it to be. We see so much of what happens in this mind, in this body, is out of our control. We don't want it to get sick, but it does. We don't want it to get tired, but it does. All of those things. And we see that we create more suffering in our life by refusing to acknowledge these things, refusing to be in tune with the reality of life, always trying to go against it, trying to make it come out the way that we want it to. And so this is seeing things as they really are. And although we've prepared the mind through meditation to be peaceful, to be energetic, it still takes tremendous strength of mind, tremendous clarity, tremendous determination to keep on looking, because what we're experiencing at a deeper and deeper level is that life isn't what we hoped it would be. Life isn't this wonderful, blissful, fulfilling all my expectations experience. You can be anything you like, they say. You can go anywhere you like. You can have it all, they say. But we're experiencing through our relentless observation of our experience that life isn't like that. And so at this stage, the next stage that arises in the path of insight is disenchantment with life, because we see its true nature, impermanent, unsatisfactory, and with no one here in control who's beyond all of this change. And so this is a stage when the mind can actually distressed, because it sees what life is really like. Not just life out there, but life in this mind and body. This stage of disenchantment is very necessary, though, for us to get to the next point, which is called dispassion. And although these things seem to run very quickly, one on top of the other, of course we're talking about a lifetime's effort to develop these qualities in our practice. Dispassion arises as a consequence of disenchantment, when we understand that life can't fulfill our expectations, that the very best of things is still only temporary. There's nothing out there that is going to bring us ultimate satisfaction. We can only go within and discover the peace that is available for us within our own mind. And so this dispassion is, in a sense, equanimity, because we're no longer drawn into or disturbed by the pleasant or the unpleasant. And this kind of dispassion is different from the feeling that we have before we start to practice, that, we don't like things when they don't go the way that we want them to, but we're very happy to jump in and enjoy it when they go the way we want them to. So we have it when we like it, but we're happy to let it go when it doesn't satisfy us or doesn't please us. This kind of dispassion is different. This is based on wisdom, on seeing truly how lacking in substance the things of this world are, and understanding that We can't grasp them, we can't control them, we can't keep them. Even those things which we thought we couldn't do without, one day we'll have to do without them. It's the same sort of attitude that we have when we see the toys that we used to play with when we were children. When we were children, we thought our toys were the most important thing. They were wonderful. If anyone tried to take them away from us, even if they were our friend, we'd get annoyed. These belong to me. This is mine. You can't have it. But now if we see the same toys, we're not interested in them. Oh, yeah. Yes, they're fun. Oh, that was nice. But we wouldn't fight over them. We wouldn't cry if someone takes it. We just say, oh, yes. It's this kind of important point, because when we see with dispassion, then gradually our attachment grows weaker and weaker to even the things in our life that we cherish. And as I said at the beginning of this talk, that when we investigate our suffering in life, we see that the degree of our suffering is directly related to the degree of our attachment. And so this is the point where we come to the opportunity for freedom. All of the other things, the faith, the joy, the meditation, the concentration, even seeing things as they truly are, even being disenchanted with them, that's a point where we can say, well, I'm giving up this practice. It's too terrifying. Not nice. We have to get to the point where we're willing to gradually let go of our attachment. And we can't do this just by wanting to, just by willpower. It's not just a matter of saying, I let go. We have to do it through wisdom. I see. Ah, this is what it's truly like. This is the true value of this thing. This mind, this body even. And then we're willing to let go. And as we let go and let go and let go, then we come to the point, the potential for liberation. Liberation, freedom from all suffering. Come with to the doorstep of enlightenment. And as some of you would be familiar with, the fact that the path to enlightenment, as explained by the Buddha, is a gradual teaching. And so on the path to enlightenment, there are four stages to reach that final point. Some people can go through those stages very quickly. For others, it takes lifetimes. For others, it takes years of practice in one lifetime. But to have a glimpse of the freedom of enlightenment, of Nibbana, that first glimpse, again, makes it clear to us that we're on the right track. Until we reach that point, we have a lot of lessons that we can learn even before we get to the point of enlightenment. The first lesson is that there's no value in turning our back on suffering, because it's part and parcel of life. So let's take a good look at it, get familiar with it, and practice at coming to terms with the little things in our life that causes suffering. Little by little, getting used to dealing with these things, so that when a big one comes along, even though it's hard, even though it's painful, even though it may temporarily sweep us away, it doesn't sweep us away as it would have if we hadn't prepared ourselves for it. The next thing we understand is that, well, if life is impermanent and unstable, all of these things, then let's appreciate what we have while we've got it. Don't take anything for granted. Appreciate our good health. Appreciate our intelligence. Appreciate our good fortune. Appreciate the people around us. Don't just expect that it's always going to be like this, that they're always going to be around, that it's going to stay like this forever. Make the most of it while we have it. And as we approach our life in this way, and we have this appreciation of the value of things, then it also helps us to open our eyes to the suffering of those around us, to no longer turn our back on the people that we might be able to help, the people we might be able to do something positive for, because we understand that we're all in the same boat, but we keep our mind buoyed and bright. by appreciating the good things that we do have in our life. So this teaching of the Buddhas is a very important one, because our normal way of reacting to suffering is to see it as the enemy. But if we can see it as the teacher, see it as the invitation to wake up, then all of us will have many, many opportunities in every day to get on with our practice and learn to be more peaceful, and eventually to set our course for complete freedom from suffering. So may this teaching be of benefit to all of you. May it help you on your own journey, and may it help all of us to attain Nibbana. Does anyone have any questions that they'd like to ask or comments? Enough. So James, if you'd like to...